listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network. Since 2009, the Pharmacy Podcast has been leading podcast publications as the insider voice of the pharmacy industry. Explore the profession and business of pharmacy through audio. Join us at pharmacypodcast.com or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or any of your favorite podcast directories.
Welcome to the Integra X-Files, a place where we'll explore and solve for the X factor that will help reshape the future of long-term care pharmacy. Join us to discuss topics and insights that will help you discover ways to grow your pharmacy, stay up to date on important legislative and regulatory issues, learn best practices for operating a profitable pharmacy business, and unlock the mysteries of technology. Join hosts Francis Nahas, Chief Strategy Officer for Red Sail Technologies, and Jim McDonald, Vice President of Sales at Integra, as they connect with experts and leaders in the field to bring you content that matters in long-term care.
Welcome, everybody, to the Integra X-Files podcast. We're really excited to be with you again today. My name is Francis Nahas. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer for Red Sail Technologies, and I'm here with my co-host, Jim McDonald. Jim, why don't you introduce yourself and introduce our esteemed guest today?
Again, Jim McDonald, the Vice President of Sales at Integra and QS1, Red Sail. Alan Rosenblum is our guest today. He's the President and CEO of the Senior Care Pharmacy Coalition. Rather than me try to regurgitate all the information about this gentleman, I think I'll let him speak and give us his background.
Well, thanks, Jim, and thanks to both of you. I appreciate the opportunity to join you for today's conversation. As Jim mentioned, I'm the president and CEO of the Senior Care Pharmacy Coalition, which is a group that represents about 350 long-term care pharmacies across the country. And we focus exclusively on federal public policy and the politics around that. And our objective is to influence public policy in ways that improve market opportunities for long-term care pharmacies, put simply. Briefly, my background is that before SCPC, I led several long-term care facility-based organizations, including the Alliance for Quality Nursing Home Care, which represented many of the largest nursing home companies in the country in Washington, the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association, which is the state affiliate in Pennsylvania of the American Healthcare Association. And although it wasn't named Leading Age at the time, I also held a senior leadership position at Leading Age for several years. For that, I practiced healthcare law and did a lot of work with long-term care facilities.
Wow, interesting. Awesome. A lot of history.
Yeah. So you recently spoke at the Integra conference, and I thought you did a fantastic job of explaining why public policy should matter, why our long-term care pharmacies should care about public policy. Would love for you to give kind of a summary of why is this important to them?
Sure. Well, it's important to long-term care pharmacies because public policy shapes what they do. It shapes the services they provide, it shapes what they get paid for providing those services, and it shapes where they can provide those services.
Yep. So one of my takeaways was a sort of, I wrote this down with a laugh, I was like, follow the money.
That's the story, I do believe.
If you look at sort of Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement, right, that drives almost disproportionately where and how long-term care pharmacies can play. Is that a fair statement, or am I overgeneralizing?
No, historically, that's very much true, especially Medicare. You know, when you look at the long-term care pharmacy sector, about 75% of long-term care pharmacy revenues come from the Part D, as in DOG program. Another 20% come from Medicare Part A or Medicare Part C for, you know, patients who are in nursing facilities who are at time of service on the SNF, the skilled nursing facility, Medicare benefit. And then only 5% is everything else, Medicaid, private insurance, individual out of pocket, and so on. Although I will note that depending on what markets an individual long-term care pharmacy may be focused on, that mix is different.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about that, because that is an interesting dynamic. I think some of our customers actually have a pretty wide, or I should say we have a wide variety amongst our customers in the type of long-term care facility that they support. Mm-hmm. So how does it differ I learned from care facility.
Oh, well, basically, if you are serving nursing facilities, let me approach it in a different way. In the nursing facility context, okay, there are basically two payers, Medicare Part A or C and Medicare Part D. So you have the residents who are on a SNF stay, which could be Part A or maybe Part C. And in that case, the dollar flow is Medicare pays the facility if it's Part A for in a kind of combined payment that includes pharmacy services. The facility contracts with a long-term care pharmacy, pursuant to which the pharmacy gets paid for providing drugs and services to people on Part A stays or Part C stays. That's, you know, so that's kind of in a long-term care facility, that's about 20% of revenues. Everything else is pretty much Part D. Yeah. Because most residents in long-term care facilities are dually eligible for both Medicare. So if they're not in a Part A stay, they are their care, long-term care is being paid for by Medicaid, but their drugs are being paid for by Part D.
Okay.
Right. And for the subset of the kind of Medicare AC population that is, you know, that has private resources to pay for care, they're just going to be in for the Part A stay or the Part C stay, and they're going someplace else. They may go to assisted living, they may go back home.
Typically on that Part A stay, the pharmacy's billing the facility for those drug costs.
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And trying to collect from that
resource.
Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, in facilities, long-term care facilities, by which I mean nursing homes and skilled nursing facilities, you know, there may be a little, like if they're on the Part A or Part C stay, there's no copay. And if those folks go home because they're not duals and they can afford to not be in a facility, then, you know, there's no copay to collect because the long-term care pharmacies are providing the care. For the duals, there's no copay or very limited, you know, depending on the state. Medicaid
program. And you say state Medicaid program, there's 50 different state Medicaid programs. So exactly. That could be confusing, especially if you service multiple states.
Yeah, because there are probably 50 different set of rules.
Oh, there's no probably about it. And, right. And then you've got Puerto Rico, for example, the Puerto Rico and Guam are going to have different rules for Medicaid.
Wow.
Yeah. So how, you know, a big trend that we hear about everywhere we go now is the concept of long-term care to the home. And obviously COVID had a huge impact on that, as we saw, you know, folks hesitant to go into a long-term care facilities or coming from long-term care facilities back to the home.
Right.
What do you see happening in that space?
A lot.
Yeah.
Next question. No.
Right.
Exactly. I guess I would say a couple of things initially. The first and most important of which is that long-term care at home is far from new.
Yeah.
You know, consumer preference overwhelmingly is to stay at home, and it has been forever. So if you are able to pay for services yourself, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you may go into assisted living if you have private resources, and that kind of is driven in part, in significant part, by what sort of informal caregiving network you have. So at what point, for example, does your spouse break down and no longer, you know,
can't do it anymore.
Or does your family support or community support no longer exist? And interestingly, from some data analysis we've done, there do seem to be two factors that play into that decision on an individual basis. One is the degree to which you suffer impairments in activities of daily living. And activities of daily living, although I'm sure most of the people who are listening to this know, those are things like your ability to get out of bed in the morning, to transfer from a standing position to sitting, or vice versa, more likely getting up, going to the bathroom by yourself, feeding yourself, stuff like that. Generally, there are six ADLs that are generally accepted, right? There are others, and people have different definitions, but those six are typically what government uses to determine whether or not somebody needs long-term care. And the breakpoint seems to be somewhere between 4 and 5 ADLs is the point at which whatever informal social support system you have breaks down and you need to be in a facility, whether that's an assisted living facility or a nursing facility. The other really interesting factor is, and it's probably not surprising, is cognitive impairment, okay. Right? The long-term care population, let's just look at people who are on Medicare that need long-term care, and there are about a little over 4 million people who fit that category. 75% of them are living at home right now, which is incredible. I would never guess that.
I would never guess that.
And about 39% of that population has, I think it's in the 30s, but don't quote me, maybe 35, but you know, 35-39% has some form of cognitive impairment. Okay. But in a facility, it's 59%.
Okay.
And so, and that's both assisted living and skilled nursing. So at some point, the combination of cognitive impairment and physical impairment as defined by ADLs, four or more, is what forces people into facilities.
And for those that are sort of aging at home or at home with one or more of the ADLs, what percent, do you have a sense of how many are being cared by a family member or somebody close to them versus home health or some other sort of healthcare professional that comes in?
I don't have solid numbers. Okay. Mm-hmm. I have some there's some data you can rely on, but my answer to that question is all of them.
I mean, right.
Seriously, right. You know, think about your own personal experience, whether it's your family members or friends or acquaintances, you know, almost everybody has some story in America, has some story these days about someone they know who needed long-term care for a parent or their own, you know, and there's always an informal caregiving network. It may not be as obvious as one might think.
Yeah.
Certainly people who have more resources can pay for more services. But again, I do want to talk a little bit about home health, because home health is both a federally defined benefit, right? There's a Medicare home health benefit, which is very limited. You need a certain degree of, you need certain kinds of healthcare services, and you have to be homebound.
Okay.
Right. Then there's,
Right. So you have to be at a physical point where you actually can't.
Theoretically, except if you go to medical appointments.
Okay. That's right.
There's certain limitations on what, you know, so it's a limited benefit, right?
Yeah.
And then there's a home benefit, at-home benefit that Medicaid provides, but of course you have to be low income for that. And then there's kind of home care, which, you know, maybe private insurance covers. Maybe individuals are paying out of pocket. So it's a real, this is the problem with the long-term care system, is that it's not a system. It's not an integrated delivery system of any kind. It doesn't crosswalk between long-term care needs, which are defined by impairments in daily living activities, and healthcare needs. And yet the people who need long-term care are disproportionately suffer from multiple chronic conditions. And as I mentioned earlier, cognitive impairments.
Right.
How does it work if the individual is lower income, Medicaid, I as a family member can take care of them, but I am not in that category? How does the reimbursement, or is there reimbursement that manages that?
Maybe. The answer is maybe. The reimbursement would come through the Medicaid benefit if your family member or loved one is Medicaid eligible. And again, then it turns on what does the state do.
Right.
These days, most states offer alternatives to so-called institutional care. That is alternatives to nursing home care. Generally, these come under there are two kind of ways that a state can go about doing this. They can offer what are known as home and community-based services, which are a variety. It's a grab bag. The state gets to pick what services they include, but federal law kind of sets the parameters on what sorts of services can be included, right? And sometimes in some states, some of the things that they can do are to do something called money follows the person, so that the beneficiary can use the money, for example, to pay a family member to be an informal caregiver. But that is going to turn on state law. And the other thing worth knowing about home and community-based services is that they are not mandatory Medicaid services. And the reason that's important is that if a service is mandatory, at least legally, it doesn't always work out that way, but legally, the state has to provide it to anybody who's eligible. So nursing home care, nursing facility care, is a mandatory benefit. If I'm a state and I want to participate in the Medicaid program and get federal matching funds, I have to make sure that everybody in the state that needs long-term care, who qualifies for Medicaid, has access to a nursing home. Now, that doesn't actually play out in practice, but that's the legal requirement.
So,
Francis, please jump in. But however, home and community-based services are not mandatory; they are discretionary. which allows the state governments to limit the number of slots available.
Yeah.
And there is a substantial waiting list in just about every state for people who need long-term care, who don't want to go into a nursing home, whether or not the service is available, and who therefore are on waiting lists to get community-based services.
You went exactly where my brain was going. Anyway, what I was going to ask is, well, the interesting thing to me is that the point you made at the meeting, I mean, 75%, is that right? Above 70% of people eligible for long-term care are at home.
Well, of Medicare beneficiaries who need long-term care, okay. There's a little over 3 million.
Okay. So my thought process was, is it physically possible for every person who would be eligible under those rules for long-term care to actually receive the care, even though they're required to provide and pay for it? My thought is just like beds. There aren't physically enough beds.
In nursing homes, there isn't enough nursing home capacity in the country, but for those folks to be in nursing homes now.
Right. And yet we're limiting
right
now by policy sort of the capacity to provide it at home for those that can't.
Right. There are certain policy limits and practical limits to providing the care at home. The policy limits largely go under the term that you know, patient advocates in particular, but it's not common in policymaking circles, is institutional bias. But what that really means is exactly what I just said. States have to provide nursing home care to everybody that's eligible, Medicaid.
Yeah.
They don't have to provide home community-based services.
And there's a limitation actually on adding nursing home beds. You can't do that?
Well, it depends on the state.
Okay.
Okay. There are two kind of limitations that could be present. One is some states limit the number of new beds that can be built in various ways. But that's a condition of state law. It's not a matter of federal law or federal policy. The other thing is that, of course, it's not necessarily affordable to build new nursing facilities because, you know, putting aside pandemic extra dollars, nursing facilities generally have had to rely on fairly robust Medicare margins to cross-subsidize the inadequacy of Medicaid payments. And therefore, it's kind of hard to sometimes, depending on the state in particular, to see the market, to make the market case for building new facilities. And when you have seen new facilities being built, generally, they're designed to have a higher percentage of short stay Medicare Part A and Part C patients. And less, and now CMS has adjusted its payment model to try to minimize the provision of therapy services. This is a little bit of an aside, but they made a change in the payment, significant change in the payment system as of October 1st, 2019 for the federal fiscal year 2020. They have 3 to 4 months to kind of get that rolling, and then the pandemic hit, right? So now CMS is proposing for an adjustment to the payment model effective October 1 of this year for fiscal 2023. That would basically cut payments by, get my math right, 4.6%.
Wow.
Because the transition from the old system, which is known as RUGs, Research Utilization Groups, the PDPM system, the new system, right? Which was designed to redirect funds away from therapy and towards non-therapy ancillaries, which by the way, include pharmacy. That was supposed to be budget neutral. In other words, the federal government did not intend to spend more or less than it would have spent if it had kept the old system in place, right? Mm-hmm. And what they found is that they've spent $1.7 billion more than what they project they would have spent. And this has been an issue for the last year or so. CMS has been trying to figure out how much of this is due to the pandemic and therefore not the facility's fault, as opposed to, although they don't say it this way, I think they think that facilities are manipulating the payment system to maximize reimbursement.
No.
Yeah. Well, let me talk about that for a second, too.
And I would say, I'd be almost certain they are, and I don't know that that's terrible thing, right? Well,
that's
like they're following the incentive.
Exactly.
Because they struggle financially.
Yeah, it amazes me how consistently the government doesn't recognize that by changing payment models, they're creating financial incentives. And then when people respond to the financial incentives, they consider it abuse. Anyways, but that's what's going on, right? So, you know, that's an issue because they're proposing this cutback. And given the ongoing impact of COVID, which still, as you know, the sector hasn't recovered yet, and the impact of inflation and the impact of workforce shortages, which are, you know, a tremendous problem and are going to be a continuing tremendous problem for long-term care. I'm concerned about the economics of that, you know.
So we've talked a lot about sort of current state and some of the trends. Would love to hear some of the things y'all are working on from a policy perspective.
Right. Well, let's stay on this, the theme of long-term care at home, because we started that. We deviated a little bit, but now I'm going to So the issue for long-term care pharmacies is that it is difficult to obtain adequate payment for long-term care pharmacy services outside of nursing facilities. For a variety of reasons under Medicare Part D policy, long-term care pharmacies are paid higher dispensing fees for patients who are in nursing homes than they are for patients that they serve elsewhere. And in assisted living, those Medicare Part D standards don't really apply. So it's kind of a food fight, right? It depends on the contract, and some contracts pay enhanced dispensing fees, but not as high as the fees you get in skilled nursing facilities, and some essentially pay retail fees. And I would say the trend is to move toward retail dispensing fees, right? And so when you look at the at-home market, you're really talking about a fight over retail versus some other dispensing fee. Okay. And so a lot of the policy a lot of the policies that would be helpful would be, how do you equalize the payment? How do you do two things? One, equalize the payment paying field. And then even beyond that, how do you recognize and get paid for the value of the clinical services that pharmacies provide? Because the Part D program does not pay for clinical services. We in the sector generally assume that the enhanced dispensing fee is designed to take those into account. From the CMS point of view, they aren't designed to take those into account. Yeah. They're designed to take into account a limited number of services, quote, specialized services that long-term care pharmacies provide that have nothing to do with clinical services. Making emergency kits available at facilities, right. Packaging, you know, all the packaging requirements, the delivery requirements, all that sort of stuff, right?
So one of the interesting things I was thinking about, because I wrote those down when you were talking earlier, was, if it's true long-term care to the home, what you've really done is take one facility and make it 100 facilities. Right. And if you're still doing the compliance packaging, you're still doing the delivery, it's actually a more complex process. And yet the reimbursement right now, the way the environment is structured, is that the reimbursement is less.
Right.
And that's purely for the med piece, right? Yeah.
Yeah. You pretty much figure it's a retail dispensing rate. Yeah. If you're talking about Part D. But this is where some interesting opportunities exist in the marketplace, because Part D may be paying for the drugs, but to the extent the services that a long-term care pharmacy provides can improve outcomes for people in ways that reduce healthcare spending, then there's a different basis to make your case that you ought to get paid more and for the clinical services, and you're looking at a different payer. Example, let's posit a long-term care pharmacy in a community that has a dominant healthcare system, right? And that healthcare system not only is providing healthcare to groups of people, but it's taking on some financial risk, either financial risk in a relationship to a payer, say an insurance company, or they're also managing an insurance benefit themselves.
Sure.
Okay, and so now they have an incentive to keep the costs of care low beyond what they're spending for drugs.
Okay.
And if you look at the patients who are going to be the most expensive, who are they going to be? They're going to be people who have chronic care needs and who have long-term care needs. It's sort of like Venn diagrams when you were in high school, right?
Exactly.
You know, there are these two circles, and in the middle, you've got these patients who have long-term care needs and chronic care needs and some form of cognitive impairment, right? And if you can save money on what you're spending to pay for the healthcare of that group, That's where if long-term care pharmacies can show that the clinical services that they provide, the medication management, the interventions, and it's pretty clear that, you know, based on what literature is available, if you think about the services that a pharmacy can provide that make a difference, right, you know, that improve adherence, and by adherence, I don't mean, is your prescription being refilled? I mean, are you really taking the drug, right? You're taking the right drug at the right time and the right dose, and not taking the meds from the other 20 pill bottles that you've accumulated that you no longer
cutting them out in half. Like
right, exactly. You know, yeah, right. And so, you know, what can you do? What matters? Well, it seems that what matters are, you know, specialized packaging that helps in adherence. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's not unique to long-term care pharmacies, right? Pill packages,
right? Exactly.
But what else? Synchronizing the scripts so that they're all getting refilled at the same time. Again, something that a pill pack could do if they, you know, but there is some benefit to having a pharmacist actually say, wait a minute, you know, this is the thing, right? There's some evidence that, and we're actually, SCPC is actually thinking about a research project in this regard, but there's some evidence that because long-term care pharmacists are familiar with the Beers criteria and routinely apply that in ways that retail pharmacies don't, that there may be, you know, there may be some difference in outcomes there, which of course translates into higher healthcare costs. And then some intervention that is meaningful to the patient between refills. Mm-hmm. So at some point, you know, weekly or whatever, some sort of check-in to make sure that people are appropriately taking their meds. Right.
Consulting.
Right. Yeah. Those matter. Those are the things that matter.
Yeah.
And to the extent that you can make that case to a payer, this hypothetical health system, then maybe you can negotiate and say, you know, we're going to save you $2,000 a year per patient in your, say, network of patients. Pay us $30 a month for these services.
Right.
That kind of thing. And then you can think about, well, what criteria qualify people to be eligible for this service? And, you know, there are various criteria you can use based on clinical needs and levels of impairment, number of meds taken per month, that kind of thing. That's where I see a lot of opportunity. And that opportunity extends in the market to, you know, MAPDP plans that are responsible for both the healthcare and the drug spend. There may be opportunities to work with home health agencies or home care agencies to help manage their populations in ways that reduce their spending or reduce their costs or reduce the penalties that they have to pay in risk arrangements.
Yeah.
So it becomes a little bit like the Wild West, right? Because unlike, you know, it's not like, here's the payer. It's not like the old days, right? Where you had Medicare and a Medicare intermediary. And Medicare intermediary was simply administering rules that the federal government put in place, and you pretty much knew what you were going to get paid,
exactly, right,
and how you were going to get paid. Which, by the way, ought to be really relevant to what Red Sail does and what Integra does, because data is king.
Oh, yeah,
right. Yep. You have to be able to prove that if you're the pharmacy, right, you're trying to negotiate these kinds of deals. You have to bring data to the table that makes your case. You have to prove that your services deliver this value and deliver it in ways that matter to whoever you're negotiating with. They're not going to prove it for you, and they're not going to believe you simply because you're good people and, you know, and you sound convincing.
Right.
Right. Show me the money again.
Follow the money.
And so the degree to which a pharmacy or a group of pharmacies or somebody negotiating on behalf of a group of pharmacies has credible data.
Yeah.
That establishes and, you know, goes a long way to proving what they're claiming, that's where you're going to be able to negotiate this stuff.
It's interesting. So the last podcast we just did, Jim wasn't on this one, we did it with Evelyn, we were talking about Six Sigma, Lean Six Sigma, and there's a saying where we say, it's like, what gets measured gets done.
Exactly.
And this is kind of the core, you know, it's like, what gets measured gets paid.
What gets proven gets paid.
Yeah.
But that's really
the data's really important.
So that to me is a real opportunity. Now, there are certain ways that public policy might change that could be helpful.
Yeah.
But I think it is politically unrealistic to think you're going to change the provision in the Medicare statute, which says to CMS, stay out of contracts, which says to CMS, you, CMS, can't get in the way of any contract negotiations between the plan, which means the PBM, and the manufacturer on the one hand, or the pharmacy on the other.
How did that start? Where did that rule come from? Do you have any?
Yeah, I know exactly. I'm curious. It's a really interesting political kind of thing, and I don't want to offend any of your listeners or either of you, but essentially you will recall that Part D is a Republican construction,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
The Bush administration, the W,
right, your right,
and
right.
W, that his administration came up with this idea.
Right.
At the time, the Republicans controlled both chambers of Congress. And so it was very important to them that the Part D program be a quote unquote free market program. Now, a little editorial comment from somebody who grew up in Massachusetts. How exactly does government paying, you know, $50 billion a year for prescription drugs not involve the government? I'm not sure I understand that. But in any
way, look at that part.
So, you know, and really the truth is that in order to get both primarily to get the manufacturers, drug manufacturers, supportive of a prescription drug benefit, the Republicans agreed that they would not let the federal government negotiate drug prices.
Okay.
And that's what the non-interference clause originally was about.
Okay.
Now, the other interesting thing here is that, you had the insurance companies that would benefit because they would be the offering of Part D plans. But think about what a PBM looked like in 2001, 2002. They were basically administrative services organizations that were tiny, right? But Part D and the inability of the federal government to limit what Part D plans could do caused the PBM problem that we have today, because it empowered them in ways that allowed them to control formularies without any real, there's some minor constraints, but without any significant constraints, which meant that they could negotiate huge rebates from manufacturers, right? It meant that they could structure the pharmacies that get into Part D networks and exclude, not so much in the long-term care space, but in the retail space, exclude pharmacies from the network, okay? Which means that they could extract enormous fees from pharmacies,
right?
And admittedly, some of that, all of that needs to get passed on, most of it needs to get passed on to the plans that they contract with. But you are well aware of the degree to which both first the PBM market consolidated, and then the PBM market essentially got acquired by insurance companies,
correct,
which now have become not only insurance companies, but the largest pharmacy providers and healthcare providers in their own right, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Which is a hard battle to fight.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which, by the way, is the other interesting thing that's happening on the public policy.
Yes. Yeah.
Because over the last, since over the last 4 years, since the Democrats regained control of the House and then regained control of the Senate and now have a Democratic president, much of the debate around, the pharmacy supply, drug supply chain and all that has turned on price negotiation. So it's basically the Democrats wanting to create the opportunity for Medicare to negotiate directly with manufacturers, which would, of course, starve the PBMs, et cetera. But in order to do that, really what you need to do is you need to change the non-interference clause,
right,
which is a third rail politically for Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's what when you get to what would change statutorily, that's it.
Yeah.
Now, if the Democrats no longer control the House or both the House and the Senate next year, the discussion is likely to flip from drug pricing and negotiation to drug pricing and PBMs.
Right. Yeah, sure.
And this will come on top of a change in the thinking of the administration around antitrust law. Right. This is maybe a little pedantic, but starting with the Reagan administration and continuing uninterruptedly through both Democratic and Republican administrations, the focus of how government interpreted and enforced the antitrust laws changed. It used to be that a couple of things mattered: price, quality, and access. The prices consumers paid, the quality of the services that they got, and their access to those services, right? Over time, this theory evolved that the only thing that mattered was price. So whatever business transactions, whatever business practices were out there, if they lowered price, nothing else mattered. Yeah. It's why a lot of the market consolidation we've seen, not just in healthcare and not just in drugs or pharmacy or, you know, CVS and Optum and so on, but overall.
Yes.
Now, Lena Khan, who is the current chair of the FTC, I don't think she's 35. And in law school, she became a nationally recognized expert on antitrust law by pushing back on this theory, particularly in the context of Amazon, but her view and a view that is prevalent now in the Biden administration is that we need a little bit more balance. We need to return to quality. We need to return to access. And we need not just to think about is the price as low as it possibly could be and for how long?
Yeah.
Right. And just to finish the thought, the reason that that's important is that it is changing the thinking on the FTC's part and the antitrust division part around PBMs.
Yeah.
And just recently in early June, the FTC voted unanimously to conduct an investigation of the six largest PBMs. So I think we're going to see a lot of pressure on PBMs. I think that's very relevant to all pharmacies, including long-term care pharmacies.
I mean, one of the things I've seen, I'm curious your perspective on this, because you're closer than I am, is that one of the other lens that creates complexity in healthcare is that it's very focused on sort of immediate competitors versus the entire system. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at particular competitors, it's just what's the price to their nearest one. So in healthcare, we have different organizations paying than are providing the service, or different than who's getting the service or providing the service, right? It's a very complex system.
Yeah.
And that as we've looked at kind of consolidation, whether it's United and Optum or CVS and CVS Caremark and Aetna, that type of vertical integration creates a really complex market that's hard to kind of put in really strict, simple FTC rules. Yeah. And so are you seeing kind of the lens change in terms of looking at the complexity a little bit more, or is it still fairly... healthcare is an odd duck.
It's a really good question. And yes, I do see the FTC thinking more broadly in terms of the conglomerates that PBMs are a part of. My analogy is that the PBMs are the spider in the center of the web. And the web includes the insurance component. It includes the pharmacy component, and really the most important aspect of that is specialty pharmacy, which I'm happy to talk about separately. Yeah. It includes primary care.
Yeah.
So the idea is, you're one of these conglomerates, right? And you offer health insurance and you offer drug coverage, and you're in the Medicare market and you're in the commercial market, and maybe you're in the Medicaid managed care market, right? And you also provide primary care in one form or another, and you co-locate, say, minute clinics with pharmacies, right? You put them in a retail pharmacy, you put them in a Kroger's, or Walmart. And so the patient comes in, goes to the doctor, gets the med, they're already standing in the pharmacy, so where they're going to fill the prescription, right? And then the prescription kind of gets, so that you capture all of that. And by the way, you might as well sign up for our insurance.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's from a business perspective, who wouldn't, right?
Genius.
The question becomes, to what degree are those practices anti-competitive in ways that hurt competition and that hurt consumers, either because it means they pay higher prices than other of us would pay, or they have inferior quality, or they have limited access. And in our space, there are arguments that all of those are true, that because of these conglomerations, consumers pay more than they otherwise would. Competition is impacted adversely. And as a result, consumers not only pay higher prices, but they have more limited access than they otherwise have to drugs that they need. And therefore the quality of the care that they receive is less, right? Now the question to me is whether the FTC will really be able to keep up with the rapidity with which these companies change their business practices.
Yeah.
You may recall a few years ago that it took a while, but the retail pharmacies got government up in arms over gag clauses.
Yeah.
Right? These provisions that said, you, the pharmacy, can't tell people that if they pay out of pocket, it will cost them less than if they use their insurance. Right. And so several years later, Congress passes a law saying gag clauses can't be used, you know, in Part D. Fine. The plans were way ahead of them. They changed that provision. Yeah. They saw the handwriting on the wall. I think they see the handwriting on the wall on this PBM stuff. And my example of that is that I did not know this until a couple months ago, that these conglomerates have now created so-called group purchasing organizations for PBMs, right? PBM GPOs. And the idea behind these is that by rolling up a number of PBMs into one negotiating entity, you get better deals. You get better deals with manufacturers, you get better reforms. Fine. But it's interesting to note that each of the major three players, CVS, United, and Cigna, have created these GPOs. Two of them are offshore, which means they're less subject to federal regulations. All three of them create a layer of opacity that makes it harder to understand what's really going on. Mm-hmm. In one case, they do, in fact, you know, in one case, in United case, the only member of this GPO holding company is Optum. So they can't, so they're not really, you know, aggregating more market share. So why do you need this company that's based outside of the United States, right? In other cases, there may be more than one member, right? But it tends to be PBMs who either directly or through their insurance companies have shared relationships, right? So, you know, again, it seems like the real reason for these things is to protect themselves from federal United States government oversight.
Yeah.
Right. So can the FTC catch up to that and kind of be ahead of that? And we'll see. We'll see how this,
if there's a investigation switch, goes. Yeah, there's a switch to challenge the PBM. Can they do that when they spread themselves out so far and to other countries?
Can the FTC do it? The FTC has various enforcement powers, and they could do a lot. Okay. Whether they do it or not remains to be seen, and whether they win remains to be seen. I mean, theoretically, they could say to CVS, just as an example, okay, you got to divest yourselves of all of the pharmacies you own. Get rid of your specialty pharmacy, right? You're either in the insurance business or you're in the pharmacy business, you're not in both.
Yep.
And you can imagine I would want to be the lawyer on that because I'd make a lot of money. there'd be huge multi-year litigation,
right?
All that sort of stuff. And we'll see whether the FTC is willing to take that on, you know? Similarly, it'll be interesting to see if the Republicans win the House, say, and they start to investigate PBMs, what they are willing to do, because they're still going to want to operate under this kind of free market rubric. And which is, again, to me, why I think on this point, the more that we or anybody that's interested in seeing this, seeing some of these abuses reined in, the more we can talk antitrust language as opposed to Part D language, the better off we are.
So it's a great, great segue. So one of the things we love to do towards the end of all of our podcasts is ask our guests sort of what's the X factor. So we have long-term care pharmacies listening today. What's the one thing they should go do differently or think about differently or go take action on based on the things we've talked about today? We've talked about a lot, from long-term care to the home, to transitions with PBMs. What's one thing you'd say, hey, go do this?
Prove it.
Get the data.
Right. Prove it. And let me qualify that.
Yeah.
Prove it to the satisfaction of the audience you want to persuade. I mean, every long-term care pharmacy you talk to will tell you that they change outcomes. Okay. What outcomes have you changed? Show me the outcomes that you've changed. And show me the outcomes that, and don't show me, don't show Alan Rosenblum that.
I appreciate it
if you would, be helpful, but show it to a PBM, show it to a Medicare Advantage PDPM, show it to a healthcare system. If you can do that, then you're going to be in a much better position. Show the FTC how PBMs are abusive.
Right.
You know, give them concrete examples.
Well,
thanks for your time.
Super interesting discussion. Really appreciate the time. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being at our conference.
Truly my pleasure. I will say that, you know, Integra and Red Sail have been, you know, wonderful partners for SCPC. And so it is more than my pleasure to join you today.
And if folks want to go find SCPC, where should they go look?
We're on the web.
Perfect.
SeniorCareFarmersCoalition.org.
Excellent. Well, go check them out. And thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Integra X-Files. We'd like to hear from you and gain your perspective on the X factor in improving long-term care pharmacy. Connect with us at IntegraXFiles.com. That's IntegraXFiles.com.